At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Terry S., our very own Terry S. from San Diego. Come on up, Terry. Let's do this.
It ain't that good. My name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. It's freaking scary, you guys. My fan club. I want to thank my family and my supporters and my girls that work with me, that I work with, for coming to support me, no matter how good or bad this goes. I just hope at the end I can drop the mic. I want to thank John for asking me to speak. Apparently he thought I had a story to tell. My story does include party favors, definitely alcohol. I've had to ruminate about this for 4 months. I tried to get COVID. I tried to leave the country. and here I am. Everybody that I talked to said that God's got you, you know, and he brought me this far. And I want to say that my sobriety date is August 10th, 2018. My belly button birthday is August 20th. 1963, so I just turned 61. I've got nine more years to be 60 something. 60 anything, I better get a personality after that. They said it's okay to breathe and think about what I'm going to say. So I came to Gail. My sponsor, I have a sponsor and I have a sponsoroo. They're best friends. And so and it takes two for me. And I'm like, Gail, listen. And I tried to read her my speech and she says, you are not taking that notebook. How good, either God is everything or God is nothing, right? And I remember that for me, he's always everything. Sometimes I don't feel it, but I know he's always working in my life and has from the day I took my first breath. And I see that now in retrospect when I look back on all that I've been through. Many of you know me as Bud Bullock's daughter and Mary's daughter. I'm also Phyllis's daughter. And so I want to say that I had a really, really good upbringing, you know, and one of the ways that God worked in my life in the beginning was, you know, my mom was married to a really abusive alcoholic, and he left my mom with me and my two brothers. We were really small, 2, 3, and 4. He ran off with a babysitter, probably got married 5 more times, had 9 more kids. We all call him Dave. but Bud Bullock, then she met Bud, and he adopted us. And he was one of the best things that ever happened to us kids. He changed the course of our life, so that guy didn't get to drag us through the mud. And he's in the Navy, and so we moved from Texas to Coronado in the little Navy housing, because he was in the Navy. We had a good upbringing, and I remember from a really early age, like I was born with a heart defect, and one of my first experiences, I think, I don't know if this has anything to do with the fact that I later became a raging alcoholic and drug addict, but I was born with a heart defect, and because we lived in Coronado, once again, God working in our life, I was able to get my heart surgery at Balboa Navy Hospital. And I remember the doctor telling me, you know, we're going to put you out. We're going to do the surgery. And I had been put out before. Like, I kind of remembered them putting me under anesthesia. And I'm like, do I get to count to 10 now? You know, I look forward to that, going under anesthesia, you know. The people would be standing over me, giving me all these toys and going by, thinking I'm going to die. And I come out, and I wake up in a different place. It was almost like a blackout, you know. And all those blackouts weren't always fun. I remember being in Coronado, we had a sailing club nearby, and they used to sell, out of Coke machines, they would sell, you know, you could get Coke or you could get Budweiser. Back then, they didn't really patrol those kind of things, and Dad would give us a $3 allowance, and on Fridays, we would go over to the sailing club, and we would just pick Budweiser, like, 3 times to get a six-pack of Bud, and we'd go climbing trees and stealing boats at the yacht club and stuff. It was a great, great way to live when you're a kid, you know. We had a beach in the front and a bay in the back and 6-pack of beer every Friday on Dad. During the time that I had the open heart surgery, I was 7 years old, and that's about the time Mom and Bud got sober. South Bay Pioneers is really a fond to me because when I was little, me and Kevin and Randy, and he'd bring his two daughters. We were like the Brady Bunch. So there's five of us, and I was the youngest, the small, you know, the little brat, tattletale. Dad would bring us, and Mom would bring us here to South Bay Pioneers meeting when we were just little kids, and they'd be smoking cigarettes and eating donuts, and there was a creek, and we'd go catch crawdads. And to come back, to continue to come back now is kind of like a family tradition. So let me get past that. My parents divorced when I was about 12 years old. We moved to Claremont. We were Claremonsters. That was a little bit traumatic because they sent my sister away, and we had been close like twins, and I thought she died because nobody was telling me where she went when she was coming back. And I fell into depression when we were in Claremont. I flunked eighth grade. Let me back up a little bit. I flunked fifth grade, too, because I was caught with the teacher's edition of the history book during a test. I mean, it was a true-false test, and I had the answers, and they were all true-false, and then the teacher was like, where'd you get this? I made them up. I kind of knew. I was going to tell on my brother, but so through these things, you know, the flunk in the fifth and the eighth grade and throughout my life, and my brother's, you're so stupid, you know, and having to repeat the grades, I just grew up with this complex that I wasn't smart enough, I wasn't good enough, I wasn't ever going to be anything. And plus, you know, my little Disneyland life from 2 to 12, you know, that life became not such a party anymore. It started to get real. I remember a first couple of drinks in Claremont one time, drinking my friend's mom's wine and riding my bike home, and I didn't want my mom to be suspicious, so I just did what I normally do, which is go on our bed and pretend we're watching TV, and I was really drunk. I remember riding my bike home. I guess it was my first drunk driving, I guess. And crashing the bike and it not hurting. Well, it was fun. Let's do it again, you know. And I crashed like three times and got home with scrapes and bruises and laid on my mom's bed. And I told her, Mom, I'm drunk. And she goes, no, you're not. And I went, bleh, and I threw up all over her bed. And she's like, Ron. Well, she got married to Ron after that. And I just remember ditching school, smoking weed, drinking. And when I was ditching school, we'd all have dinner at the table, and Ron and Mom would start in on me. Why didn't you go to class today? And Randy'd be like, yeah, she ditched class. And Kevin'd be like, yeah, she did. And then they'd all start yelling at me, well, you got to get a fucking squeak. And I would just run to my room crying, and my brothers would go, wee, they'd tease me, right? And it was just, ugh. moving on, I ended up marrying my high school sweetheart. I met, his name is Greg. Sickles, when I was 14 years old, and we had been together for like 17 years. Through that, I was drinking and using periodically, teaching kindergarten and preschool, and I always wanted a baby. I was taking care of everybody else's kids, and I just wanted a kid. We had gone to infertility. Let me just tell you that I experienced two ectopic pregnancies, and the first one, they took out the whole fallopian tube. The second one, they took out half of that fallopian tube, and then the third one cut a slit in it and took the pregnancy out. So I had like this much of a scarred up fallopian tube, and I was told I couldn't have kids. And so I drank and used on that for a long time. I was really, really mad at God. I'm like, God, I just want to be a mom. And I surrendered, and I said, okay, you know what, I can adopt a kid. I was willing to go to China, Africa, I didn't care, you know what I mean? I was down for that. And I stayed sober for a year on a no matter what. No, my third ectopic pregnancy, they give me a shot of this stuff called methotrexate, and it's designed to eat out any new cell tissue in your body, and I think it cleared out the fallopian tube. And when I was a year sober, I got pregnant again. I had all the same signs. I was still spotting. I was still sick. I was still, but they had like three doctors in the room and said, wow, you know what? Your pregnancy's in the right place. It's a valid pregnancy, and so I did get pregnant, and I gave birth to this beautiful little baby boy, and they laid him in my arms, and I remember telling him, you know what, I love you. The second thing I told him was a lie. I said, I'll never hurt you. I'll never leave you. You know, I will never suck this blessing in the face. I will not, you know, curse God, right? And I believe that to be true, and I meant that. By then I was working at Polinsky Children's Center, and I was cursing the parents that how dare they drink and use and lose these kids, and I would never ever do that, right? But I wasn't going to meetings, and I wasn't reaching out. I didn't have a good support system. I was now, and then I got divorced when I was, when my son was two, because I was bitter, angry, controlling. I didn't know how to be a wife. It was all his fault because he could still use, because he was a normie and he was this and he was that. But really, it was just me. I just didn't know how to do that. And so we divorced, and I was running around with the girls at the bar at night from Polinsky, and relapsed and getting cut off at the lamplighter, blacking out. They'd take my keys. One time they took my keys, and I had the Easter baskets for the kids in the back. And I had to go back in the morning and get the car, get the Easter eggs hidden before they woke up. That was a bad Easter. I told Gail, when I look at you, just tell me if I'm messing up. And she goes, I'll go like this. She hasn't done that yet. I love you, Gail. You are right. Nor would you. It wasn't long before I was smoking crack along with that alcohol, and I was smoking crack and drinking and smoking crack in the bathroom working at Polinsky Children's Center, and the shame and the guilt behind that, you know, and the ironies and the kind of understanding, oh, this is why they do it, because they can't stop, and neither could I. Ended up getting fired from Polinsky Center, and that was my dream job about, whatever, seven years later. I don't want to spend too much time on that. I want to say that... That's how it went for a long time. My son had to go live with his dad for about 2 years. A big custody battle ensued. Several rehab stints through, like, Turning Point and Crossroads and stuff like that ensued. And I was able to get custody back when my son was 10. That broke my heart to have lost that little boy, you know, to do those things that I did to him and said that I never would do. And to watch his little face, you know. Just with the disgust and the wonder why, you know what I mean? These are our kids. And I used to tell people, you can't just have kids and walk away and go, that was easy, and leave them with somebody else. And here I was doing all of that, you know? Let me see. Okay, God. No. I think I got sober again, and I went back to school, and I started working at Kiva as a counselor. I had gone back to school, and now I think I, like, know this disease, and it was another, like, I had 7 years sobriety, then I had 4 years sobriety. And I want to tell you that having grown up around all those holographic signs, turn it over, live and let live, first things first, easy does it, right? These things would ruminate in my head, but so did all of the things we learn when we get sober, the seeds that were planted during that time. Alcoholics Anonymous has a way of ruining your drinking if you go back out, as we hear so many times. And it also has a way of bringing you back if the seeds are planted deep enough. And so I was working at Kiva and being a counselor and thinking I knew all that. And I lost that job, and I stopped going to meetings again, stopped working with a sponsor, stopped doing the things that we're taught to do. And after I lost that job, Mom fell and broke her legs, both of her ankles. A lot of things happened. The dog died, this, that. I caught my live-in boyfriend with a prostitute, you know. It was just like, and so all these bad things were happening to me, right? And so I moved back in with my mom to take care of her. And that's not what happened. I could no longer maintain or hide the fact that I was using, and she was kind of keen to my using, and she used to tell me, you need to go back to AA, and I said, they brainwash you there. You need a good brainwashing, and I knew she was right. I just knew she was right, and my using got really, really bad then. I picked up, along with my alcohol, the methamphetamine again, and started getting really paranoid. I knew that alcohol plays different on your mind as you get older, right? But I didn't know that drugs did too. And I don't know if it was the different kind of drug, or it just wasn't the Hells Angels crank. It was I don't know whatever they have now, but whatever it was put bugs in my head that made me believe that I was being followed. made me believe that the gang stalkers were after me, that they were into my phones. I would finally my mom said, you know what, you need to leave. I'm kicking you out. And she got a restraining order. My brother let me know he'd had enough as well. And I was kicked out, so I left. I had a little Mustang that somebody had gifted me while I was doing some caregiving. It was another gift from God and a sobriety. It was a nice car. I drove it with a lot of ego. And I also drove it into the ground while I was using. I drove off in that Mustang, and I met him at Walmart when I ran out of gas. And him took me home to the peach tree where we stayed, and where it wasn't a month before we just started fighting, you know what I mean? And he was abusive. He was, you know, could get me in a chokehold and things that I said that I would never, ever, ever put up with. But I had no place to go back to, and I kept thinking I could fix him. And I kept thinking that it would change, and I didn't want to stop drinking and using, you know what I mean? And so it was a comfortable place to do that and do that whole song and dance. And so it went in the peach tree. I finally got kicked out of the peach tree, but he was allowed to stay. I don't know what happened there. But sometimes, you know, it would just get so rough that I would leave, and I ended up crashing that Mustang. One time I had the Mustang over to my son's house, and he was going to fix something for me, and he got inside of it. And I was dumpster diving. I had some things in there, like this is a really nice radio I found. It was a big boom box, right? And I remember running out going, come see this radio. It's really cool. It's in the back seat, you know. And I opened the door. And when I opened the door, I seen these roaches just go, whoosh, whoosh. And I'm like, so I took it out. I go, I don't know why it looks so nice. Cannot get rid of roaches out of a car. I don't care how many times you bomb it, there's places they hide. They just run around the dashboard, and they just. So my son gets in the car, and he opens the box to find it, and there was roaches in there. He's like, Mom, you need to drive this thing off a cliff. Like, this is what have you done to your car? What have you done to your life? And I'd be like, but Ben, no, it's okay. And many times I had to sleep in that Mustang, you know, and roaches would crawl on me, and it just felt so dirty and disgusting, and I didn't want to tell anybody about it. And so I would sleep there until one night I just didn't sleep for many, many days, and I was driving it across Adams Avenue, and someone finally sideswiped me. And I woke up in the hospital with a couple of broken ribs and this, and believing that the gang stalkers did that to me. You know, the people, the government, everybody that was following me had something to do with all that. I never got that car back, so I traded it in for a shopping cart. It was a nice shopping cart. It became a close friend of mine. We did a lot of miles. And I could just continue pushing that shopping cart, not seeing that the treatment of my son or missing my mom and my brother and having to take them to court and for what, right? They deserved the restraint. I wasn't going to win, right? But I'm like, I was going to show them. It was a very debilitating time, just going through that. So I missed them so much, and yet I couldn't feel it because I was drinking and I was using. I did a lot of dumpster diving. I would sleep on stairs of apartments I didn't know. I remember one time in January, I remember I would never ever want to be this cold again. I was just shaking. I don't even know how I got there, but I was so cold that you know, breathing that fog would come out, you know, and thinking, God, I never want to be this cold again. I thought I was not gonna live through that, you know. I don't even know how I got on top of somebody's stairs. But I made my way around places. I was in, I found myself way down by UCSD, where they're building the trolley that goes through University Town Center. You know, they were building that trolley, and they were doing a construction site in the middle, and I got stuck out there with my shopping cart that I parked, and I knew that these cars that were driving around this place were following me. They had followed me. They were taunting me, right? And in my head, I was just, like, out of my mind, and I climbed up on top of a tractor, and I opened my backpack, and I just started taking things, and because I wanted the police to come. I wanted someone to come save me, right? The buses stopped running, and I had no money. And I just started heaving things at cars because I thought those were the ones that were chasing me. And I don't know, I hit this one. I hit the windshield of some lady. I didn't hurt her, but I saw her go like this. And soon the cops came and the ambulance and the fire truck, and they got me out of there. And they took me to a psych hospital, which would be one of many. I've been in Grossmont. I've been in they called it drug-induced psychosis. I even thought they were the cops. I actually thought my mom put a notification out so that they would follow me and scare me either into committing suicide or to getting to a hospital or getting back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go to my son's work, and he's like, Mom, you can't be here. You know, you can't be here with that shopping cart. Don't come to my work. You know, I'd go to his door, Ben, you know, can you just charge my phone? He's like, no, you can't come here, Mom. And he'd slam the door in my face. And I'd say, you know what, I didn't raise you like that. And he'd say, yes, you did. Yes, you did. All those times you were sober and you treated other people like you had to shut the door. You had to not help them. You had to turn your back. You had to do that tough love. Yes, you did teach me how to do that. You know, and right now, I want to be able to, I'm 24 years old. I want to be able to call you and tell you when I have a girlfriend or that I'm moving or that, you know, something good is in my life. Hey, we got some new dogs. He goes, but I can't call you because you're a tweaker and you're an alcoholic. And he goes, and I punch tweakers in the face, but I can't punch you because you're my mom. And he goes, and right now you don't have a son, and I don't have a mom. And I was like, yes, you do. You know, I was like, you know, I could hear the words, and what I heard in my head was those seeds that were planted that said there's that frothy emotional appeal that seldom suffices. And I knew that no human power could relieve me from my alcoholism, but some of his words would have saved me if it could, you know, in that moment. And so I just remember after many trips out of the psychiatric facilities, I'd still always find myself in dark alleys looking for treasures in the dumpster. I came out of a blackout from having been drunk and up for days, and there I was sitting in the middle of a dumpster. I was in the dumpster and looking around going, how did I get here? What am I doing here? What am I even looking for? And I know I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again because it's a true part of my story. And I moved the piece of cardboard to get out, and I looked down, and I found... I said, what am I even looking for? And I found Jesus in a dumpster. True story. And I was like, yeah, right. And so I picked it up and I took it with me. But I didn't really feel it. I just thought it was just some kind of God joke on me or something. You know what I mean? I crawled up out of that dumpster and I went to the 11th floor apartment building in downtown Burger King. I went to go see a friend or something. And he's like, you can't come here. Like, you always say people are following you. Don't come here and bring them here, you know. It is, why are you coming here? We don't need your friends, your invisible friends, none of that. So I simply left and I took my little yellow Ofo bike. That's what I had at the time, you know, those little bikes you could pay for. I don't know why they said Ofo, but they did, and it was mine. And I took it into the stairwell of the 11th floor of that building where I would look out the window because I could see him driving around and waiting for me to come out, right? And... And while I was in there, I just figured, you know, no one's going to either come up 11 stories, and they're not going to go down 11 stories, so I'm safe right here, you know. And I had a little black marker, and I wrote a suicide note, you know, somebody finds me here dead. It's probably because the gang stalkers killed me. Please tell my son and my mom that I love them, and I'm sorry. And I wrote down one of my six phone numbers. I don't know why I wrote my phone number, because they're going to call me and tell me I'm dead. I don't know what I was thinking about. And none of those phones really even worked. Either one was charged, one was this. You know, it was because the gang stalkers were after me. I didn't want them to know which one I was using. I'm not even sure if they were mine or his. Or his. Somebody's. And when daylight broke, I went down the stairs, and I remember saying a prayer there, too, looking at my pipe and my bottle in one hand, and my family, my brother and my mom, and my son and his girlfriend, and the people I loved in the other going, why can't I just have both? Why can't I have both? I just didn't get it, you know? And why is it such a tough decision for me to choose between what I had before, what was so freely given to me, and that hope and that love that I felt in Alcoholics Anonymous that I ran from, right? And I had so much shame and guilt about that, I just didn't feel like I deserved it anymore. I had people along the way, some women that I would call now and then, and let me back up a little bit. When I was working at Kiva, I had a dear friend named LaVon, and she would always build me up. God, you're a great counselor. You're really, really good with these people, Terry. I don't even know why these other counselors treat you so mean. They're just bitches. Don't worry about that. Just stay the course, right? You got this, right? She was always in my court. She was in recovery. She was one of those. And she said, hey, do you know anybody that needs a therapist? And I'm like, hello. And she goes, well, I have a lady named Rhonda who has six openings, and she takes Medi-Cal and water. And she takes Medi-Cal, and I actually hooked up with Rhonda and started going with her, and I always had a lot to say. And she saw me when I was working at Kiva. She also saw me relapse. She saw the rise and decline of Terry Sickles, and she was such a spiritual, wonderful, wonderful lady that I trusted. And I don't trust too many people that easy. I don't open up that easy. As you can tell, I'm kind of shy, and unless you know me really well, I'm not so shy. And so as a matter of fact, in and out of my addiction, I always call her, help me, Rhonda, help me, Rhonda. Where are you now, Chica? She'd bring me $10 and give me some hope and say, just go into rehab, Chica, just go. So anyways, I came out of that 11-story building at daybreak. And because I had said that prayer and I wrote that note, I said, I'm going to see Rhonda and I'm never, ever, ever going back to him. I'm tired of getting my ass kicked. I'm tired of bruises on my face, running to my son, knowing that I can do better. I'm tired of the people treating me as less than. When you know, I noticed a big difference from when I was working at Kiva, and I'd go to 7-Eleven and be like, hey, welcome in, you know, but when I'm pushing a cart and I go in, they get what you want and get out. You better have the money for it. Like, they just treated me less than. And I'd think, don't you know who I am? You know, who I was? But I always knew then that I would never treat anybody different, less than, better than. You know, I don't think that I'm better than or less than a lot of people or smarter or dumber than a lot of people. I try to see myself as in the middle. So I rode that 04 bike over to the trolley, and I was going to Rhonda's office. And there was a time, there was one other thing I wanted to say. That was one time when I was out of my mind, and I was going down Texas Street. Again, I thought everyone down Texas Street was going up and down, following me, keeping an eye on me, reporting to my mom and to the people where I'm at. And I was walking down the hill, and I started throwing rocks at cars because I thought they were after me. And I walked down Texas Street, and I crossed the barrier, and the cops came and stopped both sides of traffic, and they're like, get on the ground. We're going to tase you. I said, tase me, motherfucker. I'm going to see my therapist. I would really walk around, and I had a taser, and if I was walking, pushing a shopping cart, and someone looked scary, I'd be like, bzz, bzz, you know, because I was a scared one, you know. I had an axe, you know what I mean. And but this time, I only had a rock, and they didn't, I guess, want to tase me, and I did make it to Rhonda's office, and I went upstairs, and she wasn't there, but she told her coworker, give her $10 and send her down. And I went down the elevator, and there were six cops ready to greet me, threw me on the ground, took me to another psych hospital. Woohoo! So I was on my way to Rhonda's office on one of those last nights, and I went to her office, and I said, you know what, Rhonda, I'm not leaving. I'm not going back to him. I'm not going back to the streets. I'm not leaving until you find me rehab. And so she said, hold on, Chica. She sent me next door to some clubhouse so I can hang out with the other loonies and have some lunch and be safe. And she made some phone calls, and she called me back in her office and said, I think I found a place for you. I'm like, why are you crying? She was like, Chica, you always make me laugh and fucking cry, like more than anybody. She goes, I just want you to stay there. I said, where is it at? She goes, LaVon. Now, LaVon was my friend that worked at Kiva. Her and I talked about opening sober livings, and she actually had opened one. She said, I need you to follow these instructions. I need you to get on the trolley. It leaves in 10 minutes. Take your little bike. You're going to drive 3 blocks, turn left. LaVon's going to meet you at a Jack in the Box in El Cajon. And so I rode up on my I managed to get there, and I think I got a trolley ticket, but I didn't care. And LaVon's like, Terry? Like, I guess I had a really bad haircut and a backpack and... And my 04 bike, and I weighed all of like 112 pounds. I'm, you know, sucked up, and I go, yeah, hi, LaVon. What's up? She's like, get in the car. She goes, give me all your phones. Give me all your drinks, all your dope. And so I gave her most of it. At least the phones, right, and a good-sized portion of whatever I had. And then I knew I added some in my backpack because I was just still scared to let go. You know what I mean? And she took me to this really, really, really nice place up in Mount Helix, where I stayed for a week. It had a swimming pool and a jacuzzi. She only had two people there. They had a cook, counselors on site. Like, it was a nice place. I did not deserve to be there. You know, when I walked in there, I thought, God, they had towels laid on the bed like a hotel. It was a nice sober living. I knew I couldn't stay there for long, but long enough for her to find me another sober living, another rehab. So I did my last line of coke under the cover so the cameras wouldn't see. And it was a really, really bad high for the next couple of days. That was on August 7th. On August 10th is the day that I no longer used and that I really started taking the Epsom salt baths and saying my prayers and doing whatever she told me to do. It was time for me to go to... I went to Casa de Milagros Rehab. The bed finally opened up. Rhonda came to pick me up, and she said, whatever you do, Chica, I just want you to stay there. Just stay there. I will buy you cigarettes. I will come visit. I have therapists that work there that work under me, so you'll probably have one of those. I have to keep strong boundaries, but I need you to stay there. She took me to a thrift store. She bought me clothes. I had this really pretty blue shirt, and I love this blue shirt. I'm like, I got to have it. Can you wait? She said, no, Chica, it has a hole in it. You're not getting in. I'm like, it's just a rehab. I'm just going to rehab. She said, Chica's got a hole in it. You're not going to have that shirt. Put it back. Get something nicer. And that was her way of saying that I have value, that she loved me. You know what I mean? And I see that for what it is. I kind of saw it for what it was then. She took me to the rehab where I stayed for 3 months. During that 3 months, the only thing I remember is talking to this really biker chick, going, telling her about God, and how he's going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and he's already done this and that, and she said, I don't care about your invisible friend, I don't care about your little fucking invisible friend, right? And she goes, he never did anything for me, and really, like, you're sitting here, you used to be a counselor, now you're here, it's like a cop in prison, you know? What if she's right? I said, what if she's right? But I knew she wasn't. It just made me hold on to that thought and what I knew, and those seeds you guys planted even tighter. I was in there for 3 months, and then I was called in by the director. She says, you have a phone call. And I took the phone call, and it was Rhonda. And she said, Chico, no matter what I'm about to tell you, I want you to stay sober and be honest. She goes, I have stage 4 cancer, and the only difference between you and me is I know what I'm dying of, and I know when. And she said, so just stay there. You're going to be moved to a different sober living. You know, your time in rehab is up. And I will see you in a couple of days at my celebration of life. They'd moved it up because she was given only days to live. I went to that celebration of life. Rhonda was a very good therapist. She taught anger management, drunk driving classes. She was really big in the pillar in the community. I just didn't know that at the time. And so I went to Sharp's Hospital to see her, and she was posted up with all her, they had steroids, she had back surgery and stuff like that, and she had a long line of people and suits and business people and therapists, and really, I'm just like, these are all the people she touched, and she stopped the line when she saw me, and she said, come up here, and I'm like, me? And she hugged me, and she said, I'm so glad I lived long enough to see you get your 3 months, and I said, I just want to carry your torch, I just want to be somebody else's Rhonda. Because she was that much to me. And she said, you will. She could just be honest, stay sober, and don't drink. And she just always made me feel so loved. I always hear that song, I was getting kind of used to being someone you loved. That one always makes me cry about her. So I heard what she said, but I couldn't find a place for it. So I just said, okay, now what, Terry? You know, and I was moved to a sober living in Mount Helix, one of Lucinda's places. It was also a really nice sober living where I stayed for 3 months. And then I had, it was time for me to go. I couldn't pay my rent, didn't have a job yet. And I had to move back out with him. By now we were a little bit sober. He was a year sober. No, he wasn't. He was about 6 months sober, or as much as I was anyways. And he had gotten a Vash apartment, and that's where I decided to stay. I tried that old idea. Left and right, sobriety does not fix narcissism. People that like to hit women don't stop just because they say they will. And so I lived with him for a year, and luckily it was close to my son's house, because when the going got rough, I'd go over there. Ben! He's like, you can't keep doing this, dude. You're sober. You need to leave that dog. He's like, no, he's a loser. Always will be. And I'm like, but I love him. I'll show you. And so in my early sobriety, while living with him, I had to start at the bottom. I didn't know how far I would come back from all that psychiatric stuff, all the things I was seeing, my invisible friends, the delusions, all of that stuff. I didn't know how quick or how far or what I could come back to. But so I knew I needed to take a basic job, just like somewhere I could learn how to work with people, count money. So I became humble, and I was really talking to God. I had a really good higher power. I had been continuing to go to my women's home group, Gut Level, where I had got my sponsor early on, and we were working the steps. I continued to do all that. Hold on, my train just crashed. And so I got a job at Family Dollar. Would you like a bag with that? You know, I would play music, you know what I mean? I liked that place. It worked for me. It was good. It was right size. It was humbling. I was no longer a counselor. I was no longer a child care worker, And so I worked at Family Dollar and got me a little car, did a little bit more prayer, and it became time to leave that old idea, because, you know, we try to hold on to our old ideas until we let go absolutely, you know, nothing works, right? So I knew that that was the case in this case. And so I went back to Lucinda and said, Lucinda, look, I need to transition away from here. And she said, well, I have a place, and it's with somebody you love, you know, Nancy and Aaron, and they have a room available. Come on and bring your cat. So I let my son and Lauren know, look, when he goes to work, it's go time. And so I called my son when he went to work, and they were there, and we were in and out of there in 30 minutes. Left everything behind, and I was so scared that I would go back. I was so scared that I wouldn't, that I was making a mistake. I was so scared of his reaction or that he would find me. And I just turned on my radio, and on the way to Lemon Grove, that song came on. Settle down, it'll all be clear. Don't pay no mind. You know, and this is, I'm going to make this place your home. And it was just like God singing to me. And I always hear the perfect songs at the perfect times I need them. I really rely on a lot of music. I always have. And I still do. So I got into that sober living, and it was good. And I started to settle down my little, what do they call it, trauma bond and PTSD from all this stuff we put ourselves through. We all know what that is. Started to calm my nerves and started going to meetings and still doing everything that I needed to do to stay sober. My relationship with my mom improved greatly, probably by the time I was 6 months sober. We went to lunch and we were just already in the forgiveness mode, and let's get this started. And my son and his wife Lauren, she's I call her my daughter-in-law because they're not married, but in my law they are. We had barbecues, we play pool and ping pong, and they keep me young, and all of his friends that have always known me still call me mom, and they manage Old Pet Kingdom down there, and they all call me mom too. They used to remember when I brought my shopping cart over there, and they'd be like, God, your mom's a mess, dude. And Ben's like, don't come to my work. But now I go in there, and they're just all so proud of me. And that is a really, really cool feeling. I'm pretty ADHD, so I'm kind of bouncing around. But I don't want to miss telling you that how much relationships can be mended and how God works in such mysterious ways. You know, I'm not much of a crier. I'm not much of a crier, but sentimental things, you know. And so... I was leaving one of the barbecues, and my son always walks me out to the car in the alley. It's the only time I don't go to the alley alone anymore. and I always try to get a little hug and a kiss him on the cheek and say something sweet like, hey, you know, you're a great kid. I'm so proud of you, or whatever. And this time I said, he doesn't know this. I said, well, he knows this, but you know you're my favorite baby in the whole wide world. And I kissed him on the cheek, and I walked away, and he said, and you're mine, right? I'm like, oh, my favorite baby. He doesn't know I cried all the way home. I'm like, God, thank you, God. You know what I mean? I mean that much to him. Like, I'm his favorite person in the wide world, right? He's my kid. moms and sons are close, and I put him through a lot, but we were close when he was little, and we never lost that bond, you know. And he used to tell me, you know, Mom, you're a hot mess right now, but you still have value. You raised me. I'm a good kid. I'm this. I have integrity. I'm funny. I'm good with people. Like, I'm stable, right? I love hard. He goes, and you did all this. Not Dad, not Mocha, not Nana. You did this. In other words, you still have value. Please come back and be you. I still need my mom. And I appreciate you telling me that, son. I appreciate everything you told me. Even when you said, don't pick me up at school because you look like a tweaker. You said that one. You were 8. I said, just be honest, tell me anything. And you said that. And then he immediately goes, I'm really sorry I said that. And I said, you know what? That might be exactly what I needed to hear. You know? Moving forward, in my early sobriety, I worked at Family Dollar. Got a little car, left him, moved back into sober living. Nancy was the manager at the time. She decided to go live with her daughter in another state. Lucinda said, hey, Terry, I need a new manager. Would you like to manage the house? It was just this blessing in disguise. Everything, so there's that, you know, I'm going to make this place your home. And so for the last 4 years, October 1st will be 4 years, I have my own little cottage in the back. It's a little one bedroom, and I got a puppy and 2 cats in the yard. And it's a peaceful place. And I've got 8 girls in the sober living, and they rotate out, you know, but I get to give back a little bit. I get to see in people where God is everything or God is nothing. And sometimes God is nothing for them, and I see the road they have to travel, and I have to remember when God is trying to lead their path, right? For I can't keep throwing pillows down where God's trying to get people to hit bottom. I need to know when to let go, you know, let God do his work, when I need to turn my back and do the tough love or just let go and let God, you know. And these are the lessons that you guys have taught me. After I became the manager there, I started applying for jobs as a homeless outreach worker. I always wanted to work with the homeless. And I applied, and I got a job with PATH, People Assisting the Homeless, as a homeless outreach case manager. I love this job. It helps me do service. It helps me remember to not treat these people the way that I was treated when I was homeless, to talk down to them or think less of them, but to, within PATH's means, get them as far as they want to go and help them reach their full potential. I've housed 30 homeless people in 3.5 years that I worked there, and to give somebody who came out of a tent a set of house keys, you know, and they turn the key and they go, thank you, Terry, you know, I'm not homeless today. I couldn't have done this if you didn't believe in me, and I know today that I've been somebody else's Rhonda, you know. I hear that from the sober living girls that call and thank me for my gentle way of guiding them without judging them, and that is not who I ever thought that I was or that I could be. When I was 3 years sober, I took Mom to Hobby Lobby, and she bought me. Hold on, it's a prop. Remember, I used to be a preschool teacher. She goes, here, honey, I got you a card. Thanks, Mom. And so I went home and I saw him on the counter and I took a look at my life. And today I know that it looks like this. God pushes this cart with my tokens in it. I have a lot more tokens, but you get the drift. And he makes me feel like a queen. You know, my God does. I know I'm his favorite. And they say, what? Don't leave till the miracle happens. I say, which one? You know, get ready because there's another one coming. And if you know, you know. I feel so, so, so blessed. Just by finally changing my perception and getting that new pair of glasses that you guys, seeing not everybody against me or after me, but they're all going with the flow. I sometimes like imagine myself like driving, we're all going to help, the whole traffic's going to help the homeless, and I'm in the middle and there's people behind me, right? Just so I can kind of remind myself that we're all going in the right direction or the same direction, and there's more good people than bad people. And that we all support each other. I need a drink of water. Could you guys not look at me? I'm going to poke your eyes out. So they say don't leave before the miracle happens. I'm going to put him away because he's distracting me. Show and tell. Show and tell, this is my Rhonda. I think you guys, everybody has a Rhonda. You know, sometimes I pray to God and I go, God, this is a big one for me. Please come with me. And I'm calling all angels. Her ringtone for me was that She Talks to Angels by Black Crow. And every time I hear that song, it reminds me of Rhonda. And I know God has angels at his fingertips when I need more than just God, or I just feel like maybe God's too busy for me. This time I need everybody, right? So I was going to go drive and pick up Gail. She ended up driving. But in my car was, I think we left him at your house, was God and Rhonda and my dad and another few angels that I have. We forgot them. They did? All right. Okay, well, Ben's sitting on them. So I want to encourage the newcomer that no matter how far down the scale you have gone, like the promises have come true for me. I see how all of the experience and the bad things that happened to me, God has turned it around and made it to where I could use those things to help others. Because I do believe that, like, just like one alcoholic helping another is without parallel, so is one homeless person helping another homeless person is without parallel. You know, that lived experience that I have, I've been able to put it to good use and help others and have value again and self-esteem. And so to the newcomer and to my girls in the house, thank you for your support. You guys, just please stay. God doesn't make no mistakes, and you're in our house for a reason. And we got a good house. We're going to make it a good house. It's like I told you guys last night, man, work a program, get a sponsor, do the steps. I fell on some hard times. You know, when somebody that I idolized that had a lot of sobriety had relapsed, and it rocked my world. I'm like, I never thought she would relapse. It scared me enough to know that that could happen to me again if I don't say yes to John when he asks me to speak, you know, whether I want to or not, you know, whether I feel like God is with me or not, whether I feel it or not. I need to say yes, and I need to tell my story as hard and as scary as it's been for the last 4 months. I stay the course because life has changed for me, right? I have a job that has value. I love what I do. I love the relationship I have with my mom and my son. And this is my son right here. Say hi. He's so cute. And my daughter-in-law and my brother, my mom, and Mary. And I want to thank you, Gail, because right now you're my Rhonda here on earth. You have brought me through so much more and grounded me more than I have ever trusted any woman, really, in my life thus far. And I know that you're going to help me with the steps. We're already working those steps again because I want to go deeper and I want to be freer and I want more miracles. Thank you, guys.
Terry, thank you so much for that. Was such a full circle story, and I have a feeling there's so much more to it. So please come back and share again. One more time for Terry.